Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Emily Thomas, and you are listening to the Mom Struggling Well podcast. Hey, ladies, welcome back. This is episode 107, and I am really looking forward to sharing this chat with you. I'm talking today to Dr. Kelly Flanagan. He is a psychologist and the author of a book called Lovable. The way he kind of became more well-known was by writing letters to his daughter. As he looked around our culture, he saw so many false standards and images that are passed off as true. And he wanted to make sure to tell her who she really is and where her value comes from. I gotta be honest, the book is called Lovable. It's got hearts on the front and hearts and love and talking about hearts and love and reading about hearts and love. It really isn't my thing. And because of that, I was kind of hesitant about this book. Not kind of, I was. I was hesitant about this book. Part of my aversion to all the gushy stuff may just be my personality. I'm really practical. Sometimes I don't see the value in all that stuff. But on a deeper, more raw level, I may not believe the word lovable actually applies to me. And that underlying question truly affects how I interact with others. What do I make sure I always do? What do I make sure I don't even try to do? The question mark over whether or not I'm lovable colors everything. So I really wanted Kelly on the show because I'm pretty sure that you can identify on some level with this as well. I really loved what he had to say, and I've taken a lot of the things from his book and from this chat and applied it to my actual everyday life. I am confident that you will too. Before we start though, I want to thank this week's sponsor, Anchored Press. Anchored Press is a Christian planner that keeps you focused on God as you organize your day. As moms, we spend so much time meeting the needs of others, and sometimes we end up neglecting our own souls. This planner helps us do both things. My friend Deanna has created a gorgeous resource to keep all the things together. Your times with the Lord, your plans, your goals, your go-to dinners. Your biggest problem is going to be choosing which one you want. So go to anchoredpress.com and get your 2018 planner today. All right, let's get started with my chat with Kelly. Honestly, I got to tell you, and I'm not just saying this, I love this book.
Thank you.
And it's pushing on so many nerves that makes me very uncomfortable, which is good, right?
Right, right.
But my little sister loves when I talk about her on the show. She really doesn't. But she has this weird, like, bundle of nerves on the surface of her, like, her side. You can't, like, see it or anything. But if you touch it, even really lightly, it, like, makes her shoot up into the ceiling. And, like, it's very painful and uncomfortable. And so I've thought of that. As I'm reading this book, I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is what my sister feels like. It's really good, though.
It's hitting your bundle of nerves.
It's hitting my bundle of side nerves. Anyway, so just tell us about yourself. Let's just start there.
I'm a clinical psychologist. Been doing that for almost 15 years. I started writing about 5 years ago, around the time that I started to not dislike myself so much.
Okay.
And gave myself permission to just do what I wanted to do. And so I started to do that about 5 years ago. Let's see what else. I was trained as a clinical psychologist at Penn State University, where I met my wife, who is also named Kelly.
No way.
Is also a clinical psychologist. Yeah, she is.
And you're both psychiatrists.
We're both psychologists, right? The talking kind, right? Yeah. And we're both Kelly, both spelled the same way. You know, we often tell people that about 3 weeks into knowing each other, she emailed her mom and said, "Hey, I met this great guy, but his name's Kelly, and so, you know, can't work out." So,
yeah. Did you ever think, yeah, this is not a good idea, or did she want to become Kelsey?
Right. Well, I think in hindsight, she may have held on to her maiden name in hindsight because she went ahead and took my last name too, so we're terribly confusing to everybody. Yeah. So, and we've sort of followed each other around. She was a professor at Wheaton College for a while, and I was the adjunct professor there for a while. So we confused the HR department there. We've worked at several counseling centers together and confused HR everywhere we've gone.
How do you differentiate?
So mostly with friends and family, it's Kelly Mom and Kelly Dad is the way that they refer to us. And when it benefits us not to differentiate, we do so.
There you go.
If a telemarketer calls and asks for Kelly, I say she's not at home.
That's perfect. And you have three kids, right?
We have three kids. Yeah, we had our first kid in grad school at Penn State, Aiden. He's 13 now. And then a second son, Quinn, who's 9, is at sleepaway camp for the first time this week, which is exciting and sort of, I don't know, tender and scary for us too. And then our daughter is 7, Caitlin.
Okay. What does sleepaway camp look like when there's like electronics? Like, I bet they don't have to write a letter home, or do they write letters?
Good question. So they aren't allowed any electronics to begin with.
Okay.
There is like a central computer lab where they can go receive our emails.
Oh, okay.
But they can't send emails. So they do have to write a paper and pen letter to communicate with us. So.
My goodness, like the pioneers.
Yes, and we haven't received one yet. So.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to bring that up. Sorry to push on your nerve bundle.
It's fine. It probably means he's having fun.
Oh, that's good. That's really good. Okay, so you wrote a book called Lovable, and I think even just the title, that word is so overused to where it has no meaning really, you know? And
right,
so I think you had a really big project there to make it a word that has deep meaning, and you really have. So
Thank you.
Does it mean to be lovable?
You know, it's funny, that word. I don't think I've, you know, you mentioned I have done a few of these interviews. I don't think I've ever told this part of it, which is that, you know, you write a book and you go through draft after draft, and then you submit it, and then edits after edits with editors. And the last word I wrote in the final revision of the book was lovable. And we were still searching for a title at that point. And I said, I think that might not be a bad title. And so, yeah, so we made that the title. What was your question about?
What does lovable mean? Why is it? I don't know. Because I think at first it conjures up doing the right thing and saying the right thing and being just someone that people can't get enough of. Then you're lovable.
Right. Yes, exactly. Like the perfect Facebook persona is the lovable persona, right? Yeah, no, what I wanted to do, and it's sort of what I did with one of the original letters to my daughter from the makeup aisle, where I took all these words I saw in the makeup aisle and said they need to be, they're good words, but they need to be reclaimed.
Mm.
And so lovable certainly is a word that gets all tied up with performance and attracting big crowds and so on and so forth. And I wanted to reclaim it as a word that is core to our identity and core to who we are as people, every single person, and actually sort of make the case that it's the foundation from which we do everything else, the foundation from which we love, the foundation from which we do the things we love.
Mm-hmm. It was so interesting to me to, because as a, from a Christian worldview, a lot of times we just hear, you know, you don't want to spend too much time looking inward because, you know, there's sin and we're broken and it's just darkness. The heart is deceitfully wicked above all things. And you know, that's in the Bible. So that is true.
Right.
But that you talked about underneath that, there's another underneath. We're like really valuable and loved just because.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That to me has been the greatest gift of being a therapist, is working with people for, you know, a decade and getting into that really crummy layer of things, that dark stuff under the surface that we don't let a lot of people see and that we are taught is there and need to know is there. But then to keep digging and discover that there's actually something else under that. There's a true self beneath that stuff that is beautiful and good and full of light. And as I say in the book, kind of full of the spark of God.
Yeah, I love that. So let's talk about the first thing we see, and I'm sure you see a lot when you kind of look inside, is shame. It's really big and it's ugly. Yeah. And I love in your book how you said shame is a full body experience. I totally get that. But that you said also grace is too, which I thought was great.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, what have you discovered about overcoming shame? How can people do it? Do they ever really get over it? Because I deal with that big time.
Yeah, well, right. Join the club. Actually, no. So I think the first thing that we have to say out of the gate when we talk about shame is that you don't ever completely get over it. Because if you think the goal is to completely get over it, then you've just created another thing to fail at.
Oh, good.
Your shame will feed on that failure. And what's wrong with you? You've been working at this for so long. You've been in therapy and there's still days where you feel like you're not good enough and so on and so forth. So one of the kind of one of the ideas of lovable is that it really is not ultimately about overcoming our shame. It's about getting better at listening to it, being aware of it, and then gradually over time beginning to listen to a different voice within us, which, as you mentioned, I call the voice of grace. And so, no, it's not about this battle against shame. It's more about becoming more familiar with it and beginning to make a different choice within us.
That's so good to realize there actually is a choice.
When you're not creating those spaces of stillness to get to listen to and become more familiar with your shame, it just gets so loud and so pervasive that you don't realize you have a choice. You can't hear that voice of grace that is much more subtle, much more tender, much more quiet. So yeah, the moment you start to realize you have a choice is it's a beautiful moment.
Yeah.
You know, I call it in the book, this is sort of the inciting incident of your life when you start to realize you're not going to have to listen to your shame forever.
Yeah, I have to tell you about yesterday. My house, I tend to be a pretty clean person, pretty uptight. At least that's what my children would say. And so things are usually under control, my laundry and the dishes and all that kind of stuff. My house looks like, I mean, it should be condemned. There should be the health department here. It's in a bad state. And it was dinner time, and it was just the hour where everything is on fire and it's just not going well. And I should have been rushing around trying to do something, but I had just read that part in your book about, you know, just let yourself be there and see. So I just laid down on my floor. I had no business laying down on my floor. I should have done so many other things, but I thought, well, this seems like the wrong thing to do. And so I'm going to try it. So there you go.
Awesome. That makes me so happy because that was a moment, right, where you realize, actually, I have a choice.
Yeah. It was hard, though.
It's so hard. Yeah. Good for you. That's awesome.
Thank you. So I still have laundry to do today, but I did do some of nothing yesterday.
Yeah, you do eventually have to get to it. That's for sure.
But it is really good to know you have a choice. So in the book, you talked about worthiness and then belonging and then purpose. And I know because I've just struggled with feeling important in my identity for my whole life, like is common to so many people. I just search for my purpose first. And then I end up very confused about what's going on. And so I know that the reason you did worthiness, then belonging, then purpose had a reason. So talk to me about that.
Well, yeah, because I think a lot of us find ourselves in the same boat with you. You know, over the years as a psychologist, I started to realize that people were coming into me and they were basically saying one of two things in different forms, that my relationships aren't working, or I really don't feel like I have a clear direction in my life. I don't know what's going to make my life meaningful. And so I spent a lot of time trying to help people, like you said, trying to figure that piece out first. And over time started to realize that people were trying to solve their worthiness issue in their relationships and with their accomplishments, and which neither one can solve. So in my own work personally, in my own journey, and then as a professional as well, I started to think of these things as a progression, that we begin to remember our worthiness, embrace it again, and then our relationships become an expression of that worthiness rather than a search for it, right? Like, I have to get you to love me. I have to get you to affirm me in order to feel worthy. What happens to a relationship when I already feel worthy and now I can enter it without that need, without that compulsion and that dynamic? Things get really exciting and fun very fast in relationships, and simpler rather than so complicated. And then this idea that you've embraced your worthiness and you've begun to reveal your true self to people because you trust that it's good. And now certain people are starting to respond to that. They're excited about getting to see who you are, and you're starting to get a sense of who your people are. And then you say to your people, hey, I think I want to go out and do this thing in the world. I want to do this thing that I've always been passionate about. I feel wide awake when I do it. I feel alive. Your people say to you, hey, I love it. It's perfect. It's just what you should be doing. I love to see you happy. Go do it. And then they support you in doing it. And vice versa, of course. You're doing the same thing for them. So this progression from worthiness to belonging to purpose, to me, is sort of at the core of how we grow as people.
Yeah, because I think if you're looking for your purpose first and then you change what you're doing, you feel like ashamed that you messed up the first time instead of it's a different iteration and you're growing as a person and all these things. Not that I have any personal, you know, experience with that.
And by the time you get to the end of lovable, that is what I'm talking more about, is the cyclical nature of these things, that as you go through this cycle of kind of embracing your worthiness, trusting that you're lovable, becoming more authentic with your people, trying out new things that you love to do, then something happens. Like, you try something new and it doesn't go well, and you find your shame gets kicked up all over again. Or you try something and you go, this isn't exactly what I want to do, actually. This has become more of a burden than a blessing. And so anyhow, you go through this cycle over and over again of refining your sense of who you are and who your people are and what you want to do. My wife and I went through a big stage in that 2 years ago when she'd worked for her entire adult life to become a tenured professor of psychology at Wheaton College as the director of her graduate program, and said, this isn't what I want to do. This is what my shame has been telling me I had to do. I had to achieve and produce. And what she had always really wanted to do was to actually provide psychological services directly to kids who were under-resourced and weren't typically able to access those services. Okay. And it's beautiful. Literally, maybe 2-3 months after she said that, I got a call out of nowhere from someone in my hometown, which is a small, rural, relatively impoverished town, from someone who said, "Hey, would your wife be interested in a job running a clinic in our town?" And so that sort of sealed the deal for us. We made the move about an hour and a half west out into the countryside to return to my hometown. So was her entire adult life a mistake? No. Like, it was learning. It was figuring it out. You know, it's messy. You know, you don't learn the lesson all at once. And there might be new things in the future, too. I don't know that she'll be doing this forever, but you're figuring it out as you go.
Yeah, my husband always says nothing's wasted. And I just think,
that's good.
If I didn't do it right the first time, it's all wasted. So, yeah. He's helpful to you. I'm glad for him. So speaking of that, though, what's it like to be married to a psychologist and be a psychologist?
It can be a total disaster. And I don't imagine our kids have much of a shot at psychological health.
Okay, I'm sure. Whatever.
Well, you know, that's the way, like, I don't know. We're fighting against the odds. How's that? Psychologists tend to do too much work at home. How's that?
Okay.
And so that is the temptation, is to do too much work at home, to worry about, okay, I've got all the training to tell me how you're supposed to turn out right as a child, right?
Okay.
And in reality, what I need to be doing is taking more of a hands-off approach and affirming who they're already becoming, right?
Yes.
So I think that's how a psychologist sort of make a mess of things. But we try not to overanalyze each other. When we do, it never goes well.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, I think all of us do that with our spouses, but you've got the words and the degrees behind it. So, but you both do. That'd be,
I know,
tricky.
The challenge is to increasingly trust the other one to reveal what's true about them rather than thinking that you know what's true about them.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully that's a mutual thing. And that's something that we're working on, like, yeah, everybody else.
Oh, yeah, totally. Okay, so talking about affirming, like, the worthiness of your kids, you mentioned a story, and I'm only in chapter 15. I really wanted to be done, but I just had to stop and read so much of it over that I'm behind where I wanted to be, but I love it. About red Kool-Aid, you snuck in and you drank red Kool-Aid and it made your teeth all red, and it didn't go well for you because you weren't supposed to be drinking that Kool-Aid. But then you talked again about how you had trophies and that you found that you had done really well in some things and your parents were very happy when you did that. And it's so hard because we are happy when our kids succeed.
Yes.
We aren't pleased when our kids make poor choices. So how do you not shame them? How do you still accept them?
Yes. It's such a great question. Yeah. The story you're referring to is that I snuck downstairs at 6 a.m. and drank Kool-Aid and, you know, kid, plaque all over my teeth, captured all the red dye. And so it's pretty obvious what I'd done, and I got caught and I lied about it. And I don't remember a whole lot. I just remember feeling terribly ashamed, like that I was a very bad boy.
Mm.
And then shortly after that, one of my other earliest memories is getting a trophy for soccer. And my parents were happy with me. I sort of remember them standing around me and just the sense of pride swelling up and the sense that, like, ooh, I want more of this. I want more of my parents proud of me and not my parents upset with me, which, again, like, it's totally normal. So, yeah, and you're asking, what do we do about that, right?
Yeah, and you also, I'm sorry to pull in a bunch of stories, but when you were talking about some, I don't know, maybe it's also soccer, but that when a kid makes a goal, he looks at you like, are you proud of me? And then when he doesn't make a goal, he looks at you like, am I still okay? How do we check and see if we're shaming them? Or how do we, like, take the temperature of their feelings of themselves? Because my kids, they don't really have great amount of words for that.
Mm.
I'm kind of met with nothing.
Because
maybe they don't know.
Yep. And what you're getting at is, so one of the core ideas that promotes shame is that we are what we do, that our actions are equivalent to our worth. And that's a bad cycle to get into, because that means when things are going well, you feel really, you know, great about yourself. You think you're worthy. And that when things aren't going so well, you think you're not. And so we do want to, as much as possible, help our kids disconnect their sense of worthiness from their performance. Now, that gets complicated, right? Because shame is a great way to get kids to perform. If they think their worth is dependent upon doing exactly what mom and dad want them to do, that simplifies parenting an awful lot. And if you get short-term results, the long-term effects are someone who's spending their life thinking that they have to keep doing all of the right things to be worthy. It's a huge burden to be carrying around. And so I think the goal is to be always talking about, always explicitly saying that, you know, of course we love you, but this isn't working. This isn't working out for you. My daughter recently, she said something really sweet. I had scolded her or something for, I'm sure it was fighting with her brother because that's all they do lately. And then I was getting her a snack and I was being loving her. I was being kind to her. And she goes, Daddy, why are you getting me a snack if you're angry with me? And I said, oh, sweetie, I will always love you because of who you are. No matter what you do, you'll always have Daddy's love. And so there are plenty of opportunities to try to disconnect those for our kids. And if we don't explicitly disconnect those, they'll naturally begin to link them together because it's natural to do. They're trying to come up with cause and effect. Okay, I did this and Mom was upset, so Mom must love me less. We have to sort of be really explicit about how those things don't go together.
That's really important. Yeah, we have to say it because we may know it, but we may not say it. And I think the biggest thing that parenting has brought up in me is that I don't know that. And so how can I love my kids unconditionally?
That's it.
So it's so important that we deal with our junk, but it's so hard because we don't really have time to deal with our junk, or it doesn't feel like it because we're so busy keeping them alive right. And dealing with their junk, right?
So true. You know, and I think you sort of nailed it. And I think it's why people say as they get into Lovable, they have to put it down and take breaks because, you know, there was a point in thinking about what kind of book that I wanted to write where the agent that I work with said, you know, I think everyone's responding to these letters you write to your kids. I think you should write a parenting book. And I came home to my wife and I said, you know, Kathy wants me to write a parenting book. And my wife was like, that's not what you should be writing. You are not a parenting expert, buddy. And she was right. And the reason the letters were resonating as we started to think through it was that even though they were letters to my kids, they were being received as sort of letters to the kid in every reader, the kid that's still inside of us, that still needs to heal, that still needs to relearn that my performance is not the same as my identity. My performance is not the same as my worth. And the truth is we can only take people as far as we've come, right? So we will only be able to communicate that to our kids through our words and actions to the extent that we've healed that lesson inside of us. So I think that's exactly it. So as you're reading Lovable, I hope that's what's happening is not just for readers' ideas about how to parent their kids, but also a sense of healing for the little kid in each of us.
Yeah. And there's so much hope when you talk about the little kid in us. I think I have a bachelor's in psychology. So, you know, some of these concepts I understand, but that doesn't mean I live them out. It just means I understand them. It means I read about them in a book. But but I think that there's also a lot of hope when you, like in your words, when you say you've forgotten that this is true about yourself rather than because when we look, we just think all that's down there is ick and mess and mistake. And so to realize that no, you just forgot. Gives a lot of hope.
To me, it's the absolute best gift my children have given me is to get to watch these little people grow up before they encounter shame and start to forget that they're worthy and to be like, oh, you just know it. Like you live it, you breathe it. This is not a question for you. You know, what do I got to do to be good enough? It's self-evident to them. And that really drove a lot of my own healing, frankly, and going, I've forgotten.
Yeah.
It's not that I need to somehow go out and build an identity or create a sense of worth. Those things are in me. I just lost connection to them. And so that's the tension, though, is that in order to reconnect with those things, I also have to reconnect with the shame that separated me from those truths. And that's the painful part. And that's the reason that it's the good stuff always lies on the other side of the hard stuff.
Yeah.
But that is the journey. Somehow, in the midst of keeping all these kids alive and still loving themselves is to figure out how to love ourselves again too and remember that we're worthy.
Hey guys, I want to pause really quick and tell you about my experience with HelloFresh. HelloFresh, if you haven't already heard of them, is a meal kit delivery service that makes cooking more fun so you can focus on the whole experience and not just the final plate. Each week, they create new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions that are designed to take about 30 minutes for everybody from novices to seasoned home cooks. HelloFresh sources the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantities needed so there's no food waste. And the best part, the part I love, is that it's less than $10 a meal. In my experience, the days that HelloFresh arrives on my doorstep are the days when I have zero meal plan because a lot of times I just have zero meal plan. But then when all of a sudden I whip up like a steak and nectarine salad, my family's like, who are you? We like it, but what has happened? It's because HelloFresh happened. The other thing I love about HelloFresh is that my daughter, who's 9, really likes to cook, and she really likes reading their easy step-by-step instructions, and kind of, she ends up cooking dinner, and I just kind of make sure nothing catches on fire. So I don't have to go shopping for it, and I don't have to cook it, and it's really good ingredients, so all I basically have to do is eat it. HelloFresh is my favorite. So for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter MSW30. So again, that's HelloFresh.com, coupon code MSW30. Let's get back to the show. I loved what you talked about in your, like, your childhood. Your parents were not the Cleaver family, particularly.
No.
And I think that sometimes people who come from harder places, again, we disqualify ourselves because our testimony or our childhood didn't look like that person's. Mm. So I mean, again, that's just shame, right? You're a great example that somebody can come from not the most favorable conditions and still be a very right. healthy person.
Yeah, well, thanks for that vote of confidence that I'm very healthy.
Okay.
I appreciate that. Well, I think we'll get my 13-year-old in here and see what he thinks. Right before I set him downstairs with the laptop so it'd be quiet. And I go, hey, buddy, be careful with that. He goes, oh, yeah, Dad, I woke up today thinking I'm going to ruin a $1,000 piece of equipment.
So nice.
Like, don't tell me I need to be careful. I know I need to be careful. So he'd probably have a different opinion about my health. But but no, to your point, one of the things that changed dramatically for me was when I shifted from this idea of trying to have a good life or a perfect life to thinking about how can I live a redemptive life? How can I look at my history? How can I look at my pain and say, what fruit would redeeming this do in the world? And so, no, we don't have to come from perfect backgrounds. None of us do. So thankfully, we don't have to, right?
Yeah, that's true.
We just get to sort of say, okay, this is the history. This is the pain that I experienced. And what is healing going to look like? And how is that going to be unique for me? And, you know, my parents are both very good people, but just people. And that's, you know, part of the challenge.
Yeah, for sure. So you write in your book that there is loveliness even in our ordinariness. And as somebody who's struggled, like, I really tend to find my value in my accomplishments. And so that's why being a mom, honestly, was so hard, because I felt like my life was over because I really couldn't accomplish anything that I cared remotely about, which is why I started this whole podcast. So how does ordinary, how is that lovely?
So shame is whispering inside of us in many of different ways. It's saying, essentially, you're not good enough. And the subtle addition to that is, so you have to do something that is more than enough in order to compensate. Mm. And many of us are driven by that. People, it sounds like you and I have similar temperaments in terms of being kind of achievers and doers. And so we're particularly caught up in that. And so this idea that when we begin to get connected with the voice of grace within us and shame starts to lose its influence on us, we actually say, I'm totally okay right now the way I am. If I never accomplish another single thing in my life, I am worthy. And so for me, the word that has captured that experience is that it's okay to be ordinary. I don't have to go out and be extraordinary to be enough. I already am. And it's something that I wrestle with, because I also realize, like, again, temperament-wise, I am an achiever. And so I do like getting things done, accomplishing and creating and knocking off projects. But what I've started to be able to do is, again, disentangle that part of me from the sense of shame that I have to do those things to be worthy. Now I just get to do those things because I enjoy it.
Okay.
It's fun to do.
That's a really good point.
That's the difference, is I don't have to do it to prove myself. There's nothing to prove. I just get to enjoy being productive.
That's good.
Unless you have kids.
Well, I just feel like because I connect my worth with productivity and because I really enjoy productivity, I feel like, mm-hmm. what am I supposed to sit around and do nothing? So I love the separation, yes. that you get to do it. That doesn't make it bad to get stuff done.
I honestly don't think I started to realize that until nearing the end of writing Lovable, that, like, you're never going to want to quit doing things excellently. It's sort of part of how you're wired. Like, my blog post goes out every Wednesday morning at 5 a.m. and, you know, my eyes will pop and open at 11:30 on Tuesday night and go, oh, that's what I want to write in the last paragraph. And I'll get up and I'll go change it. And not because I'm, well, decreasingly because I am worried about what people will think. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And increasingly because that's fun. That's fun for me to get there. And so, but it is disentangling it from the sense of compulsion that we have to do it to be worthy.
Yeah.
That's sort of the game changer.
Yes, for sure. Now, okay, you mentioned it earlier, but in your book, you talk about an inciting incident and how that is the concept that the moment in a story where a story really begins, something really shifts for the main character.
Mm-hmm.
It makes them head towards the heart of their own story. So I loved what you said about the inciting incident, is that it's not about making our inciting incident happen, because that would be my thing, is mm-hmm. what do I need to do to make this happen?
Right.
But it's about making the conditions right, you know, to let it happen. So talk to me about an inciting yeah. incident. And if a mom is feeling like, what is my life?
Yes.
Who am I even? Tell me how she can make the conditions right for an inciting incident.
Yeah, and I love that to put it in the context of being a mom, or if you happen to be a dad, a stay-home parent. You're so much of your life is about the identities of these other people, right? And wanting to encourage them and cultivate them. So it can be so easy to lose that sense of identity ourselves. And if we're not being intentional about it, shame does step in and start having its way and start speaking pretty loud inside of us. And so I think you actually already gave the example of how to cultivate an inciting incident in that moment. When the house is spiraling out of control and you've got dinner to make, you've got a bunch of people who are about to be disappointed in you, for you to say, I'm going to create a space here for stillness. I'm going to create a space here for quiet. And the really good news is that the natural state of your being is to be quiet and still and connected to the voice of grace within you. And so you don't have to work harder to make that happen. You have to slow down. You have to learn how to be still. I spent some time on Facebook Live this morning talking about practice of mindfulness and the importance of beginning to just notice all of our thinking and judging and that voice of shame telling us we have to do this or that, and beginning to release it slowly so that as we get more and more quiet, we can't help but hear that voice of grace inside. So those are the conditions: are stillness, quiet. I'm not trying to make it sound easy because it's not. It's really hard.
Yes.
It's really hard to slow down. It's really hard to create that space. I mean, as soon as you get into that space, you hear the shame louder than ever going, you got to be producing something to be worth something, So you have to sit through that. You have to wait for that to begin to quiet down, and that can take time. So, but I do think those are the conditions that I'm talking about in the book.
Okay. I think it's interesting because even when I sit down to read the Bible or pray, I don't feel that, even though I'm not really quote unquote doing anything, because I feel like I am doing something. So if I haven't assigned a value to the task I'm doing, then it's like everything in me to try to sit down and make myself do it because then I'm not valuable when I'm not doing it.
Yes, exactly. I got into this crazy habit, this was years ago, of every time I'd watch a movie, I'd write it down on a list, like in a Microsoft document. Almost like, okay, if I write it down on my list, I've done something,
That is so funny.
Versus just like, you're here to enjoy as much as possible. You're here to do what you need to do to get by and then enjoy the rest. And so for me, prayer has shifted from a time where I've got my to-do list of people that I'm supposed to be praying for and so on and so forth, because that to me just becomes another achievement thing, another performance thing. And instead, it's become a time where I begin to let myself quiet down, get still, listen, and try to have some space to reconnect with that voice of grace. I did a podcast interview a while back, and afterwards I was like, oh my gosh, I botched that so badly. Like, that was the worst interview I have ever given.
Really? Okay.
And yeah, the shame just kicked up and just incredibly. And for a couple of days, I was in it, shame spiral. Like, I couldn't even barely show my face in public because I felt so vulnerable and raw. But then thankfully, I remembered my own advice. And so one morning I was out on a bike ride, cultivating that sense of stillness. And I got reconnected with that voice of grace within me. I just heard what I heard inside, again, not in an auditory way, but was, Kelly, it's really hard to learn on a big stage. I'm proud of you for getting up there. And that was all I needed. It wasn't like, oh, you did great. Oh, it's fine. I'm sure people liked it. It was, yeah, probably didn't go very well. And that's hard. It's hard. But you took a risk, and I'm proud of you. Good job.
Because that's what you talked about, yes and, right? Like you were talking about the voice of shame, and then the voice of grace comes in and says, yes and. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like the voice of shame says, your hips are too big. Or in my case, your love handles are too big and you're not worth anything. And what we try to do inside is go, oh, no, they're not. Or I'm going to get in shape and then it'll be better. And the voice of grace comes along and says, yeah, you sort of have always been tubby, Kelly, ever since about fourth grade. But you know what? It's okay. It's all right. Not a big deal. It's not who you are. Don't worry about it. And so there's this undoing of this battle we try to get in to try to prove to ourselves that we're okay. And it just says, none of it's evidence, one way or the other, for your worth. Your worth is already decided.
So good. So really practically for a mom who feels like she doesn't understand what you're talking about when you're saying to kind of get in a calm place, she has thoughts that are racing. What do you mentally do with the thoughts when they come in?
I'll tell you that one thing I've learned being a dad of three and being home with them a decent amount is that if I'm starting to feel overwhelmed by them and resentful towards them, it's usually because I miss setting a boundary somewhere for myself. And I think there's a lot of parents out there who feel like it's not okay to set those sort of boundaries. So, you know, these days I'll say something, you know, because they're each asking for three things at once. So three kids, yes. That's nine things.
It's a lot of things,
right?
Man.
And it's a lot of things.
And then as soon as you take them to do something, they come home wanting to do a whole nother thing. I'm like, we just spent 4 hours at the pool. I'm not taking you to ice cream for the love.
My kids never want things more than after they come back from a great vacation, because they've just been getting, right? And now they're like, can we go to the carnival too? And I'm like, your whole life's a carnival. No, you can't do that.
Yeah.
So for me, it's saying, I've actually done one time I did this. I said, okay, guys, I'm going to take requests just like a DJ. You have to put them on a list. You get to alternate 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. I will do as many of them as I can get to, doing those things slowly and with patience, because if I don't do them slowly, I'm going to get mad at you, right? And I don't want to do that. So let's work through them slowly. And whatever we don't get to, we'll have to get to at another time. And so, like, setting that boundary for myself of just saying I'm human and I can't do it all. And I might upset you, I might disappoint you, but I'm modeling for you that that's okay, that I'm not going to so overextend myself that I can't even be patient with you, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's a piece of it. So they're setting boundaries on our kids. They're setting boundaries on our time. I love, again, what you did, just taking a moment out, just a moment to say, okay, for a minute, 2 minutes here, I'm just going to breathe. One of the most powerful practices is a mindful breathing practice where you simply pay attention to your breath, pick one point in your body where you're feeling your breath, and bring your attention to bear on that sensation at that point in your body. And when your mind wanders, bring your mind back to it.
Okay.
Now, to me, why this is such a radical thing is, if you do it first thing in the morning, is because first thing in the morning, what you wake up with is a sense of, I got to start doing, right? Because my worth is dependent upon doing. So for 5 minutes, you're totally rebelling against that idea. You're saying, actually, my goal to start the day, the first thing I'm going to do is to practice something that is an expression of my sense of worthiness, that I don't have to do anything in this 5 minutes to be worthy. And if you can practice it for 5 minutes, then you can practice it on the go for 10 minutes and 15 minutes and 20 minutes. And building in that kind of presence to your life, I think, can be pretty revolutionary.
I like it. I know you're a Christian, but I noticed that a lot of your book doesn't use Christian words. And I have to say, I'm assuming that was on purpose, because once we've been in the church, we have to really try hard to not sound ridiculous and, you know, only applicable to the church. So I appreciate that, first of all. And so talk to me about why you did that.
Well, and I'm really grateful to Zondervan, who is used to publish things written in more traditional Christian language, that they essentially let me retain my writing voice. So my writing voice emerged out of years of being a therapist. And while I work with Christians, I work with a lot of other people as well, people of different faiths and people who don't have faith. And I don't cease to become a Christian when I work with them. That doesn't, my worldview doesn't change. My understanding of how we're created and how we're healed, it doesn't change. But my language has to work with people of other traditions and so on. So as a psychologist, I've learned ways to talk about the wisdom of my faith tradition in ways that can be received by other people. And I think that naturally transitioned into the way that I write as well. And so one of the things I wanted to do with the book is I wanted to be honest about my faith, but continue to write in the voice I've been writing on my blog for 5 years, you know. The worst thing would be for my blog readers to read for 5 years and be excited about a book and then discover that all of a sudden I'm using all this code language they don't understand.
Yes.
So that was the goal, and I'm grateful that Zondervan gave me the space to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's really important that Christians step outside of that little subculture so that we can share the hope we have. And unfortunately, if we don't be intentional about it, we don't do it. And then we start saying weird words and people are like, what does that even mean? Are you even a real, like, are you serious about that? Which is fine. There's nothing wrong with those words, but it just, I don't know. I just appreciated that about your book. And in fact, like, a lot of people listen to the show and they don't know it's a podcast where anybody's going to talk about God. And so they accidentally listen and they think, oh my gosh, I had no idea God thought that about me. I never would have listened to the show if, you know, so anyway, I just appreciate that about your book.
I'm glad that was helpful to you too. And I'm excited that people of faith, they share the worldview, and so they resonate with it at that level. And then people who don't are still able to receive the message about their worthiness and their love.
Because it's truth. Like, it's ultimate truth. And so you can receive it.
Well, and actually, when you look at the letters of Paul, when you look from letter to letter, he uses very different language in every letter, uses different metaphors, uses different cultural examples. And that's because he's writing to people in different places. Mm. And so he's saying, well, what's the language? What do I got to do to communicate the truth of my experience to you? And so he is absolutely willing to use the language of the audience to communicate that truth.
Yeah. I'm in a class with the Navigators right now. Do you know the Navigators?
No, what is that?
It's like a Bible study. I don't know how to say it. Anyway, it's a class at my church. It just like teaches you how to follow God. Like, what does an equipped disciple look like? And part of that is sharing your story. And part of sharing your story is figuring out how to say it in less than 3 minutes. Like, what were you before? Mm. What changed? What's going on now? But then taking out all the special Christian words. Mm. So it's a lot harder than it seems. But once you do,
absolutely,
you've got a way to share your faith. People can't argue with your story.
Yep. There's this sort of theologian philosopher guy, Peter Rollins. He's an Irish guy. And one of the things he does with this faith community, this Christian community over in Ireland, is they go to participate in worship services from people of other traditions so that they can be reminded of how weird it is to walk into a religious culture that you're totally unfamiliar with and go, I feel like such an outsider. I feel like an alien here. And in that way, kind of develop empathy for people who are coming into the Christian community and don't understand any of the language. So I think it's good to be reminded of that. I love that the program you're working through is conscious of that. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really good. Okay, so we're almost out of time. I have one more question for you. You are not prepared for this, but I like to end the show with asking, and I'm assuming that you do not listen to a mom podcast on a regular basis, but what can you not stop talking about?
I think I've mentioned it a couple of times. I'm trying not to talk about it because I'm aware this would be one of those things that I just annoy the heck out of everybody with.
Okay, that's perfect.
I've gotten into bike riding again.
Okay.
For the first time in many years. I had a bad back injury 7 years ago now, and I'm healthy again for the first time enough to ride a bike. So like every blog post I want, or in fact, the blog post that I published today is about riding straights versus curves and how when we ride the straightaways of life and everything's going perfectly, it seems great, but the wind's moving too fast past your ears to really take in any of the beauty around you. Okay. And it's when you hit the curves and you have to slow down that you actually start to take in the beauty around you. And so maybe that's one of the ways that suffering redeems itself is by slowing us down enough to be reminded that there's beauty even here. So it's a biking metaphor, but I don't want every blog post to be a biking metaphor. So that is one thing I'm trying not to tell people about. I mean, one thing that I am telling everybody about is the television show This Is Us. A lot of people have heard of that NBC show.
Yeah.
The thing that I love about This Is Us is the way they tell the story illustrates ordinary people doing the best they can, still messing up, and it doesn't shy away from the fact that those mistakes we make have long-term consequences for our lives. You know, the past is never in the past. It's always present in the little one that's still inside of us, still wanting to be loved in certain ways. But they do such a beautiful job of depicting how these people who were broken and doing their best they can are now in the present moment, working for healing, working to give each other grace. It's absolutely gorgeous. I love it. I cry almost every time.
I know. It is so good. Well, Kelly, so good to talk to you. Thank you so much for being on my mom podcast.
It was an honor to be here. Thanks for giving me a chance.
You're so welcome. Thank you for your book. And actually, I'm going to start doing a book club. And I really think this would be a good one for the moms.
That means so much to me. Thank you. But like you said, you got to give yourself like an extra cycle to finish it because everybody puts it down all the time. So.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, it's going to be the book club for 2 sessions.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, thank you so much, Kelly. Right. You enjoy the rest of your day. Go ride a bike.
All right. Sounds good. Go lay down.
Yeah, I know. Right? I told you that was going to be good. I hate to say I told you so, but I totally did. The thing that he said that I continue to use is yes and when my internal shame monologue starts. For example, I hear in my head, you are such a bad mom. You are so harsh with your tone just now with your kids. So then I say, yes, and I apologize to them and they're able to see their mom being humble and depending on God. My friend Victoria wisely pointed out this week that yes and is so powerful because our enemy confuses and deceives us using half-truths. So instead of battling shame by saying, my tone was fine, I can embrace what's true about the situation, my tone wasn't that great. Which then lets me move to the larger big T truth that God is still totally into me. He's my biggest cheerleader because he knows my heart is for him and he is after my good and his glory. And he is absolutely glorified when I don't live under shame, but I walk instead in freedom, knowing my true identity. My friend Gina this week also reminded me of something that goes along with all of this. Exodus 14, 13 through 15 is so good, you guys. I've talked about verse 14 before, that the Lord will fight for you, you only have to be still. But the verses before and after are really amazing. So in this passage, God's talking to Moses, and then Moses is talking to the Israelites. So it's kind of like a heavenly game of telephone. So just picture that. So the people are freaking out because the Egyptians were coming to get them. It's understandable. They're trapped between the Red Sea and horse-drawn chariots coming to get them. God's response to Moses, when Moses said, "They're freaking out, God." God says, "I'll fight for you. All you gotta do is be still." Moses was apparently still talking. Maybe he didn't know whose turn it was in the telephone game. Because then God interrupted him and said, "Why are you still talking to me about this? Get moving." It's like the same thing we wonder when, in a scary movie during a thunderstorm and the bad guy's breaking in to kill the girl, we wonder, why the heck is she going upstairs? Why are you still in the house? Get out of there. So that's kind of like what God was telling Moses. Now, on the surface, that makes no sense. So do we stay or do we move? Do we be still or do we get going? The answer is both. Using the yes and is how we do that. So while saying yes to the shame lie of our enemy, it may seem like we're agreeing with the enemy of our souls, which is really not a great idea, but it's really actually the yes is taking a firm stand on the fact that we aren't perfect. Yes, I did mess up. Yes, I am a real jerk sometimes. Yes, my weakness is what allows God's strength to be that much more amazing. Yes, you're right. I am weak and I jack up a lot of things. I am standing firm on God's worthiness, not mine. So that's the yes. Yep, you're right. That's a thing that happened. But then the and part of yes and is the part where we move. And I am loved anyway. And I restored things with my kids when I messed up. And God will turn these messed up things into something for His glory and my good. So I think of the and as that first step out of captivity. Because as soon as God had told Moses, "Why are you still talking? Get moving." He raised up his staff and the Red Sea parted and they walked across on dry land. So it was like, be still in your spirits. You don't got to do this. I will do it. And then get the heck out of there. Get moving. Put one foot in front of the other. Man, that gets me all fired up. So let's go ahead and stop there. Our strategy for all of us to struggle well this week is by listening for the lies that you're hearing in your own head. Listen for lies that you can hear your kids telling themselves. "I'll never get this math problem. I'm never going to be able to figure out how to ride a bike." Listen for those lies. Pay attention. Listen for the shame that's coming at you all day long. Stand still and move by using yes and. Okay? I wanted to remind you of several makers that we have who have joined with the Mom Struggling Well show to make items that are available for you to purchase. There are Milk and Honey shirts, the t-shirts. There are mason jar tumblers from Drink-A-Doodle-Doo with those cute striped straws. They're adorable. There's woodblock signs from Sila Signs. And there's a mug coming out this month. I'm so excited. From Natalie at NS Pottery. All of these makers give a portion of the purchases back to the show to keep it going. So your purchase is great for you, it's great for them, and it's also great for the show. You can find all of their items at momstrugglingwell.com under the shop tab. I hope you're as excited as I am to tackle these shame statements this week. We can do this. We just have to stand still and move at the same time. Oh man. All right, ladies, I hope you have a great week of struggling well.